The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
It's Friday, August 19th, 2022. I'm Jackson Bird. Today, competitive life-saving and the USA Mullet Championships. Just a couple of niche competitions to kick off your weekend with. Plus, a possible new method for removing those pernicious forever chemicals from rainwater. Here's some cool stuff for your ride home. Last month was the 11th annual World Games in Birmingham, Alabama. Taking place every 4 years, 1 year after the Summer Olympic Games, the World Games showcases sports that used to be in the Olympics or hope to be in the Olympics one day. And over the years, this has included sports as common as racquetball, triathlon, and softball, as well as the more niche baton twirling, mini golf, boomerang, and tug of war. There are so many fascinating sports to dig into when it comes to the World Games, but last month was the 11th annual World Games in Birmingham, Alabama. Taking place every 4 years, 1 year after the Summer Olympic Games, the World Games showcases sports that used to be in the Olympics or hope to be in the Olympics one day. And over the years, this has included sports as common as racquetball, triathlon, and softball, as well as the more niche baton twirling, mini golf, boomerang, and tug of war. There are so many fascinating sports to dig into when it comes to the World Games, but a recent profile of one in particular by Emma Basilieri at Sports Illustrated particularly stood out to me. Competitive life-saving. It's a swimming sport focused on techniques for saving human lives. Growing out of 18th and 19th century European rescue societies, the sport today is made up of some lifeguards and some people who are just enthusiastic about the sport and what it stands for. And while many sports leagues have a charitable arm or encourage acts of service from their athletes, life-saving's governing body, the International Life-Saving Federation, goes a bit further. They kind of double as both a sports federation, making crucial decisions about the minutiae of various events within the sport, and as an NGO, whose recent work includes helping with a UN resolution to lower global drowning rates. In fact, on their Wikipedia page, of all the things it's listed that they do, life-saving sports comes last, after drowning prevention, water safety, and generic life-saving of the non-competitive variety. Current ILS Federation President Graham Ford explained to Sports Illustrated that while life-saving as a sport might seem odd at first, it's all in service of the Federation's larger goal of drowning prevention. And as Sports Illustrated summarized, quote, "Every lifeguard who becomes more invested in his skills because of the sport is moving a step toward global water safety. And every lifesaver who isn't a lifeguard is still someone who's far more equipped to save lives than he would be otherwise." End quote. But how exactly does life-saving as a sport work? Well, in the World Games, there are 16 different medal events in life-saving, mostly races of varying lengths divided up by gender, but the races are not straightforward. They include additional challenges and obstacles and bright orange mannequins who need saving. Sports Illustrated explained the 200-meter super lifesaver, quote, "The beginning could pass for an ordinary swimming competition, 75-meter freestyle with no fins, no mannequins, no lives to save. This opening section is just about speed, but it soon gives way to a blitz of strategy and technique. First up, rescuing a submerged mannequin. At meter 75, each competitor must dive to the bottom of the pool to retrieve a mannequin, and, this bit is crucial, must bring it to the surface within the next 5 meters. I mean, it only makes sense, some life-saving technique it would be to keep the life in question underwater. The swimmers carry these mannequins 25 meters, but once the swimmers reach the wall, those first mannequins can be left behind, representing one set of lives saved. This is the halfway point. Now the competitors must prepare to rescue the second mannequin, which is floating instead of being submerged. For this one, they'll use equipment rather than simply carrying the mannequin themselves. Each swimmer has to grab a rescue tube and a set of fins from the edge of the pool. They get the gear on their person as quickly as possible and swim 50 meters to the opposite wall. There, a floating mannequin awaits, and they must secure the rescue tube to the mannequin, ensuring it is clipped on two places and tow it the last 50 meters to the finish, end quote. Despite all of that extra work, lifesavers are so quick that Sports Illustrated notes that while the men's world record for the 200-meter freestyle is 1 minute 42 seconds, the men's world record for the 200-meter super lifesaver is just 20 seconds longer at 2 minutes and 4 seconds. Pretty impressive. Many of the competitors, who could easily go on to be impressive competitive swimmers, say straight-up swimming is just too boring for them. They like the effort and skill that comes with life-saving, even if it lacks a lot of the recognition of traditional swimming. Maybe that should change, though. You know, I feel like a sport like this, with such a noble and practical humanitarian element, should really be more well-known and celebrated. On the other end of the spectrum, however, have you heard about the USA Mullet Championships? Launched in Michigan in 2020 to recognize the huge increase in mullets during the early days of lockdown, the USA Mullet Championships is an online competition in which people send in photos of their rad mullets and the public votes on them. There are several divisions, including a men's open, a women's division called the Femullet, a kids division, and a teen division. And it is the kids division, currently in its final round of online voting, that has captured the internet's attention this past week. Not only are all the photos of the kids absolutely incredible, but their names are exactly what you might expect from a mullet competition. Levi, Cash, Ridge, Rustin, Brock, Axel, and even one kid whose first name is simply Epic. The particulars of each of their hairstyles vary. One even has an American flag shaved onto the side of his head. And almost all of them are from the South, and as Input Mag put it, quote, "These kids seem like they could eat some chili. They seem like they were born with an innate ability to drive a four-wheeler. Maybe they should have trading cards," end quote. They should absolutely have trading cards. And while voting is about to close on the final round for the kids and teens divisions, I have good news for any mullet-rocking adults listening. The 19 years and up open division, which seems to be all genders this year, is open for registration until August 31st. It costs $10 to enter the contest. Half of the entry fee is donated to the Michigan Wig Foundation. Apart from the fee, you should fill out the online application and include a few photos of you and your mullet. And the winner will get a $2,500 cash prize. And by the way, if you want to learn more about the mullet, the USA Mullet Championships website includes a Hall of Fame with celebrities ranging from Billy Ray Cyrus and Mario Lopez to Joe Dirt, as well as a surprisingly detailed history of the hairstyle. The site notes that the hairstyle dates back at least to the ancient Greeks and was popular among many different cultures around the world throughout history, in part due to its practicality. It did not, however, get the name mullet until the early 90s, popularized by the Beastie Boys song Mullet Head. And I was particularly pleased to see the site acknowledge the place of the mullet in queer culture. Writing on the present-day popularity of the hairstyle, the site says, quote, "Especially amongst women in the LGBT plus community, the mullet is becoming as big of a fashion statement as it is amongst guys. Combine this cut with absurdly large earrings and colorful pants, and you're ready to tell the world, hello, ladies, I too am gay." End quote. Now, if you're worried about what sort of message your particular mullet might be projecting, you can also peruse their explanations for 10 different styles of the mullet, from the modern to the Kentucky waterfall, to ensure you're pulling off the exact vibe you were going for. What a wealth of information they have to offer over at USA Mullet Championships. You know, they may not be saving lives as directly as the competitive lifesavers, but they are helping revive a once dominant hairstyle from the brink of death. You likely heard the news earlier this month that rainwater is no longer safe to drink almost anywhere on the planet due to so-called forever chemicals. Poly- and perfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, are synthetic substances used in hundreds of everyday items, from nonstick pans and food packaging to adhesives, paper, and paint. New research out of Stockholm University, which looked at four specific chemicals under the PFAS umbrella, found that levels of at least one of those in rainwater all around the globe often greatly exceeds the drinking water advisory levels set in the U.S., although it should be noted that different nations set their safety levels at different amounts and that that level has been going down, becoming stricter over the years. Quoting the BBC, "Much research has been carried out on the health risks posed by PFAS, and scientists say that exposure to high levels may be associated with an increased risk of some cancers, fertility issues, and developmental delays in children. However, such associations don't prove cause and effect, and other studies have found no connection between PFAS and disease. But for those who have spent years working closely with PFAS, the evidence in this new research paper underlines the need for a precautionary approach. In this background rain, the levels are higher than those environmental quality criteria already. So that means over time, we are going to get a statistically significant impact of those chemicals on human health," said Professor Crispin Halsall from the University of Lancaster. "Removing the chemicals in the study from drinking water at treatment plants is possible if expensive," end quote. Well, seemingly right on cue, researchers at Northwestern University published the results of a study yesterday showing that PFAS can be destroyed using two relatively harmless chemicals, sodium hydroxide, also known as lye, and dimethyl sulfoxide, a chemical used as medication for bladder pain. Quoting NBC News, "Previously, the only operational way to break down PFAS was to expose the particles to extremely high temperatures, sometimes above 1800 degrees Fahrenheit in an incinerator. But that energy-intensive process can still release harmful chemicals into the environment. The new method appears to be safer and more energy efficient. The Northwestern scientists added PFAS molecules to a solution of lye and dimethyl sulfoxide and exposed them to temperatures of 248 degrees Fahrenheit. The chemicals degraded into fluoride ions and other harmless byproducts," end quote. Turning them into something harmless is key, because current attempts to filter them out of water means the PFAS still exist and have to be gotten rid of somehow. And if you dump them in a landfill or incinerate them, evidence has shown that they're still blowing around in the air. Now, in theory, this new process would be like the one proposed by the BBC, removing the chemicals from drinking water at treatment plants. But NBC News notes that the water would probably have to go to an off-site treatment facility, so there's a big question of scalability. One piece of the puzzle might be finding a way to destroy PFAS at even lower temperatures than the impressive 248 degrees this team achieved, you know, perhaps even at room temperature. And other teams of researchers are currently working towards this goal. And this new method doesn't destroy all harmful chemicals. A brief overview, quoting NBC News, "PFAS were invented in the 1930s and used in nonstick and waterproof coatings for consumer goods starting in the 1940s and 50s. Since then, the chemicals have been found in all sorts of household items, including carpets, cookware, and personal care products. PFOA and PFOS were largely phased out of U.S. chemical and product manufacturing in the mid-2000s, but have since been replaced by a newer group of PFAS chemicals called Gen X. But the older chemicals persist in the environment, including in drinking water," end quote. And this new method from the scientists at Northwestern worked to destroy PFOA and the Gen X chemicals, but not PFOS, So their next challenge is finding a way to effectively destroy PFOS. And their study also experimented on PFAS molecules at pretty high concentrations, higher than what is typically found in rainwater, but the team believes the same method will work at lower concentrations. So all around, lots of work yet to be done, but some very reassuring news after all of those headlines about rainwater everywhere being undrinkable. Spider-Man is back in theaters next month. Not another version, just a re-release of the astronomically successful Spider-Man No Way Home, but this time with 11 whole minutes of new footage. Titled Spider-Man No Way Home, The More Fun Stuff Version, it'll be playing all over the world. The US, New Zealand, Hong Kong, Egypt, Mexico, Canada, and more. Check your local listings or go to Fandango's website to see if we'll be screening near you. It's still not clear if this will be a one-day affair or if the more fun stuff version will be screening for a few days or weeks. I'd bet on it just being a Labor Day weekend thing here in the States, though, so if you are interested in it, I would keep an eye out on ticket sales in case they go fast. This re-release is something of a victory lap for the movie that has become the number 3 highest-grossing domestic film of all time, and number 6 globally. The film was such a hit last winter that Saturday Night Live wrote a sketch of President Biden pleading with the American people to stop going to see Spider-Man because it was clearly the main cause of the then surge in Omicron infections, which honestly I wouldn't completely argue with. The movie has been available on demand and Blu-ray for a while, the latter of which already includes some behind-the-scenes extras, but people seem just as stoked to return to theaters to see it once again on the big screen. But that is going to be about it from me for this week. This show was produced by Ride Home Media. I'm Jackson Bird, and I will talk to you again on Monday.